Today up here, we are kicking off a new series on Esther and the hidden hand of God. Now, Esther is actually not a very well-known book of the Bible, I've found. In fact, for the first 7 centuries after Jesus, not one commentary was written by any of the early church fathers on this book. Martin Luther wondered why it was even included in Christian canon, because it truly is unlike any other book in our Bible, as we're going to discuss later. Plus, there are many people who doubt the events of Esther ever actually occurred, and they instead believe it to be a fictional tale, because while we have record of King Xerxes, there's no record of a Queen Esther. And so, like many other aspects of the Bible, people like to say that if there's no outside evidence of a person or a place, that must mean that it is all made up. But for Christians, and through archaeology, often where people say, well, this town never existed here, this person never existed there, eventually discoveries come around and prove over and over that what is in the Bible actually is true. And just because right now it has never been discovered is not proof that it is false. Remember, we are people of faith. We are people who trust that what God says is true. So now, with all that said, we also have to recognize Esther is actually probably the most captivating book in the Bible. It's got a plot that goes up and down. It's got a heroine and a villain and a major plot twist. In the end, the good guys win. And while Christians may not make a big deal of this little book, it's an incredibly important book to the Jews today, because it tells the story of Jewish survival in a moment when they were supposed to be wiped off the face of the earth. So there's a Jewish festival that has been celebrated ever since the days of Esther called Purim. And today, Jews still go to the synagogue and they have a reading of the book of Esther. And every time the name Haman, the villain, is said, they all go, boo! My brother is telling me he's converted to Judaism. He and his kids show up with what's known as groggers. And there are these noisemakers, and you shake the noisemakers every time that the bad guys are doing it to drown out the sound of the reader who's reading the bad news from the book of Esther. Like, it's this really rowdy occasion, but it gives the Jews hope because it's a reminder that God will never allow them to be wiped off the face of the earth. And so if you want to open your Bibles to Esther chapter 1, we're going to be reading that whole chapter today. Now, a side note, if you're turning to Esther chapter 1, our Bibles are not put together chronologically, okay? So first you have the Torah, the first 5 books of the Bible and its history, and then you have the books of history, and Esther is the very last of the books of history. So it's right after the book of Nehemiah. And then you have the books of wisdom, and that's Job, Psalm, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Song of Solomon. None of that is necessarily in chronological order. So if you're looking for Esther, it's after Nehemiah, even though historically it takes place before Nehemiah, and it's before Job, even though chronologically it's after Job. So confusing, but that's where you're going to find it in your Bibles right now. And what we're going to focus on today is all sorts of ways that power is being played in the life of this king Xerxes. We're looking at this powerful king and his queen, and we're going to see what happens when you think that because of your position, you have absolute power over everybody around you. And so the king in this story, King Xerxes, is actually a well-known king of Persia. And he ruled from 486 BC to 465. Persia is a huge area there that on the far east side, it incorporates Pakistan, Afghanistan, and reaches all the way to India. To the west, it goes all the way through Egypt and down to the African nation of Sudan. It goes through all of Turkey, and you see it stops right before Greece there in the upper left-hand corner. And that is only because Xerxes is most famous for unsuccessfully trying to conquer Greece, but he was never able to add it to his empire. So that's a little bit of the backstory. It takes place in Susa, we're going to read, which is kind of in the middle of that empire of Persia. Incredibly large, tons of power, covered over most of the known world. And that's where the story begins in Esther chapter 1, verse 1. This is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all the nobles and officials, the military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, that's six straight months, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king then gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other. And the royal wine was abundant, in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink with no restrictions, for the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man what he wished. So Xerxes became king when he was 33 years old. 3 years later, he has this monster party. He's 36, he's young, and he's showing off to all of his friends and basically all of his employees, his military leaders, all of his incredible wealth and power. And after 180 days of showing the splendor of his kingdom, he decides to have a party and to prove to others how great he truly is. So in this week-long banquet, aka a bender, that's what it's called when you're drunk for 7 days, he says, let the wine flow. Don't cut anybody off. Let them have as much as they want. No limits. So you can imagine the scene that is likely going on with all the men having unlimited access to alcohol. Then we get to verse 9. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. So the women weren't there to temper their husbands. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zethar, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. So first, he displays his opulent wealth as part of showing off his power. Now he makes a drunken request, and he wants to display the beauty of his wife. While he's proving to all his buddies how great he is, she's entertaining the wives. I can imagine these are two very different parties, what she's doing in the courtyard and what he's doing with all the guys. But he decides at the end of these 7 days that he wants all his drunk buddies to ogle his wife. Sounds to me like a really bad request. And then it says here that the eunuchs were to bring Queen Vashti wearing her royal crown. Many have believed through history that there's a lot here that's not said. Not to show up in all of her royal robes and her crown, but to show up only in her royal crown so that they could all gaze upon her beauty. Talk about something that is just incredibly demeaning to Queen Vashti. You know, for some reason, he thinks this is a great idea, but he's the king. He has all the power, so he can ask for whatever he wants. And that's exactly what he's doing here. First, he shows them that he's got more wealth and more money and more power than all these nobles, and then basically ends the party by saying, "And my wife is hotter than your wife." And we look at this and we go, okay, that's one way to play this. And I think this scene fits perfectly the phrase, drunk with power, right? He's young and prideful and he wants everybody to know it. But the Bible warns of this kind of pride and power in the famous proverb that says, pride comes before the fall. And in another, the Lord detests all the proud of heart. So we shouldn't be surprised at what we're going to see comes next in this story of Esther. Even so, we see this is all around us more than we'd like. It's not just King Xerxes thousands of years ago. This power and the resulting pride that comes from it has a corrupting effect. And that corruption affects our politicians, our pastors, and all sorts of people in high office. We see people who run for politics that we're like, they're a great person. And then something happens when they get to Washington. And we go, how did it become about the money? Or we see pastors who build small congregations into large mega churches, and we assume that they must be incredible men of God. And then we hear these stories about their moral failings or their corruption with the finances or their anger issues. And we go, wow, these people that rise to the top often have this corrupting effect that eats away at their character. And it takes them to a place where they make some really silly decisions, some regrettable choices, just like King Xerxes here. So for us, we need to understand, just because a person has acquired fame and power does not mean that they necessarily deserve your allegiance. Xerxes was on top of the world, proud of all that he'd become. But as we look through his decisions in this book as a whole, we're going to see he was not a leader worth following. Now we get to verse 12. So he's made this power play. He said, bring her out with her crown on. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, he didn't even go talk to her himself. Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and he burned with anger. The story is a little bit ambiguous here. We actually don't know why Vashti said no. We don't know if she's being rebellious or if she's being courageous and standing up for her morals. The expectation was that no woman was going to say no to their husband. Some of you I know maybe have been raised in marriages where just, you know, you did what your husband wanted to. You submitted and that was part of what your marriage looked like. And so if that's the case, and we know it is with the king, the expectation is she's his wife, she should say yes. More than that, he's the king. She must say yes and comply. Is she rebelling against him because she thinks she has her own power? Or it's very easy to understand also, at that time, it would have been common when the drinking got out of hand that the wives would leave. And that's why when the men would bring in the prostitutes and the concubines and the dancers, and that's when the fun really started. And so it could have been her saying, I'm not going to be any part of what you guys have been doing for your 7-day banquet. I'm not showing up. And then this is an ethical decision on her part. But the text doesn't give us any reason to side on either end of the spectrum here. And any spin we try to put on this situation truly will be filled with our own bias and what we come to the text with culturally in our own experiences. What's most important to this story and all that the story communicates to us is that she denied the king's power. And as a result, there were consequences that were going to follow, consequences that are incredibly important to what happens later in this book. And so then the result, obviously, is burned with anger. He's a man who's not used to being denied. He always gets what he wants. And so his absolute power has led him to believe that he can control anybody and anything every situation because he is the king of Persia. But clearly he just found out that even his authority has limits. Vashti was not coming. Verse 13. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of the law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king. Karshena, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsena, and Memucan, the seven nobles of Persia and Media who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. According to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. So we've got this situation now where he doesn't know what to do. So he goes to his nobles, his experts of the law, and he says, hey, you need to help me figure out based on the law that we have, what am I supposed to do? And what's clear here is he has no relationship with Vashti. He wasn't able to be like, hey, hon, I'm just so proud of you. I think you're a great wife. I just want you to come around and meet some of the fellas. Like, we do that in America. There are moments my wife's like, fine, I'll come with you to this event, but I don't really want to. And I'm like, please, I love you. You're the best. He's not doing that here. He's like, I sent my eunuchs. She said no to them. What are we supposed to do? There's no play on the relationship here. They never talk together. This is simply a relationship of command and control where he says, jump, and she's supposed to say, how high? No matter who you are or how important you think you are, we all need to understand you have less power to control others than you might think. If you've ever raised a toddler and you've tried to make them eat their vegetables, you learned this very humbling lesson. Unfortunately, there are still people today who think that they can just tell others what to do. Positionally, I am your husband, you must obey. I am your father, you must do what I say. I am your boss, I don't care what you think, you have to do it my way. And for a time, that works. If a person is forceful enough or charismatic enough, they can get what they want most of the time. But since nobody can truly control another, there are moments when people say to you, no. There are lines that when crossed, people will stand up for themselves. And if you're conditioned to expect to rule by coercion and force, it makes you furious to be defied. So you shout louder and you bang the table harder, hoping that somehow that's going to make a difference. And so if this sounds a bit like you, you need to change and repent. And if this sounds like somebody you know or you're close to, I'm sorry, because I know that can be exhausting being in a relationship with a person who tries to control you regularly. Side note, I got a sheep story I've been holding on to for weeks. I was trying to move my sheep from one paddock to another paddock. Normally, this is easy. I open the gate, they see fresh grass, they run through. But they got sidetracked. They saw some clover. And I thought, oh, come on. I got to get to work. It's time to move. So I thought, I will walk around behind them and I will drive them from one paddock to another paddock. I don't know if you don't know this about sheep. You can't drive sheep. You can't come from behind and push them, force them to where you want them to go. It's only five ewes. That's it. And I could not for the life of me get them from point A to point B. Instead, they scatter and they run everywhere and they're farther from where I want them than where we ever started. It was a humbling day to realize how little control I had over these simple beasts. And in the same way, we have to recognize in human relationships, you can't expect to push people to where you want them to go. Sometimes it works, but often it deteriorates the relationship. And eventually, people will scatter from you and they will deny your power. Verse 16. Then Memucan, Smart guy, he comes with a solution. He replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, "Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and all the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, 'King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come.' This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end to the disrespect and discord." This story cracks me up. As I'm listening to Mamukin speak up, he's saying, "King, this is not just your problem. I mean, I know you're having marital issues and all, but now this is going to impact me and my wife and my buddies and their wives. As soon as they hear that one powerful woman was able to say no to her husband, then I might hear no from my wife, God forbid." And reading between the lines, many scholars believe this was not just about obedience, but it was about sex. And like we talked about last week, men tend to like sex. And so that hearing that this idea that the women were not going to listen to their husbands was not going to be okay. He ends it with, "There will be no end of disrespect." And I find this line to be so over the top. This potentially very understandable refusal of Vashti, like if he was really asking for her to come out with just a crown and nothing else in front of all of his drunk buddies, I think we hear that and we all go, "Yeah, that seems reasonable for her to say no." But it feels like it's being blown out of proportion into a this terrible future if this situation is not addressed swiftly and forcefully. In fact, this personal slight between husband and wife is now going to require a royal decree that goes out to all the land, because the fear is that it's going to infect every single marriage. So in a humorous turn of events, Vashti's denial of one request has lit an entire battle of the sexes in an entire empire, causing the men to worry about what their wives are going to do, and an entire empire-wide uprising of the women. As humans today, we have a tendency to blow things out of proportion. I think I look at this and I'm like, it's amazing how this small thing became this fear that just amplified into like, we got to send a decree to everybody. We got to stop this right now. When your kids get one bad grade, maybe you're like me and you jump all over them very quickly. Like, "You're never going to college because you let one class slip." Or maybe your spouse does one thing that drives you bonkers and you immediately are thinking that they're doing it just to annoy me. They're doing it on purpose. Like, we let small things become big things in our minds. But often, stepping back, you gain some clarity and you realize you don't need to go nuclear on something that's really not that big of an issue. I know from experience that there are times I have let my fears and my personal sensitivities allow me to turn molehills into mountains. And stepping back and getting a night of rest and sleep at this moment is often the best remedy to overreacting. Making those decisions sober is also a good idea. And that's not something that they did. When you read this, they're at the party, they're on the 7-day bender, and he immediately is like, "What should we do?" And there's no pause here. There's no time has passed. These guys are in the middle of it, and they're like, "Let's make this decision right now." So Xerxes moves quickly, and in the heat of the moment, when an idea is proposed, he responds, he thinks that it's wonderful. So let's continue in verse 19 through the rest of the chapter. "Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then, when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all this vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. The king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in their own language, proclaiming that every man should be ruler over his own household, using his native tongue. So, we've seen Xerxes displays his power, his opulent wealth. She denies it. Memucan has this major fear that they're going to lose power. Like, this is all power at play. And finally, Xerxes is like, no, I'm putting my thumb down and we're stopping this. And he is going to exert his power now. Vashti is stripped of her title of queen. She's never to see him again, and her position will be given to another. Interestingly, this is the only fact from the entire chapter that matters to the rest of the story. Nothing else in chapter 1 really matters except Vashti is no longer queen, and there is now a vacancy open for another. By telling the women what happened to the queen, then these men, these husbands, are expecting, fantastic. My wife is going to have to respect me. If this can happen to her, then it could happen to me too. So they're glad. It's going to put some fear into their wives' hearts. And the decree to go out to all parts, to each province, to each people, is demonstrating how vast the rule of Xerxes is. Make sure you don't forget how powerful a man Xerxes truly is. This man who has to order wives to respect their husbands. These guys all thought that this edict was great. So the order was proclaimed that every man should be ruler over his own household. And they're thinking this is going to solve everything. The problem is they failed to recognize that respect is earned and not ordered. You can't demand somebody respect you if you are not respectable. They might obey you in your presence, but it's not the same as if you foster a real relationship, where they trust your leadership and they're actually willing to follow you. That's the model for marriage that we see in the New Testament. It's not husbands demand of your wives. It's husbands love your wives. Wives submit to your husbands. There's a working together. In fact, this idea that these guys had to send an edict demanding respect undermines the belief that they had any real power at all. Like, if they had power, these things should happen naturally. The fact that they have to tell him, you must do this, and the king's going to make it so, just proves that they don't have any real power in their own homes. So while this first chapter of Esther tells a captivating story of power plays and dynamics, what's interesting is when we get to the New Testament, we see Jesus comes to this earth and models an entirely different way to execute power. He flips how we understand power. Jesus never tried to push on people. He instead described himself in the terms of a shepherd. In John chapter 10, verse 27 and 28, he says, "My sheep listen to my voice. I know them and they follow me. I give them eternal life, and they shall never perish." Jesus exerts his power in a completely different way. He washed the feet of his followers. He touched the lepers that nobody would come within 50 feet of to bring healing to their skin. He spoke to the hated Samaritan woman. He gave his life for his own people. With Jesus, we don't see edicts going out commanding people to follow him. He knew that doesn't work. It never has. It never will. Back to my sheep story. So, the sheep are all over the place. They're in the paddock. I've tried driving them. But that's not how sheep work. Sheep want to follow good things. So I go to the barn and I get the orange bucket. And I put the treats in the bucket. And I shake the bucket. And now I've got five sheep right behind me, coming straight with me. And I'm taking them home to their new paddock. And they trust me. They see I've got good things for them. That's how sheep work with their shepherd. I'm learning. I'm new to this game. Sheep will be led, but they don't want to be pushed. And the same is true with us. Jesus knows that. And that's why he came and he says that he is the good shepherd. He calls out to us. And then he leads us in a better way. He leads us to a better home. He isn't going to chase you into heaven if you don't want to go. He's not behind you with a stick saying, go to where I want you to go, because he knows that just scatters the people. Instead, he's leading, he's calling, he's wooing. He's saying, come, I've got a different way. That's how Jesus exerts his power. His power is not ever exerted over us, but it is always extended to us. He calls out and he invites. As you consider what chapter 1 of Esther teaches you today, I hope you see that holding on to power, bragging about power, and trying to control others through your position are all a fool's errand. Many men have tried this tactic known as command and control, but it often fails to win the hearts of those following. For the short term, it succeeds, but it is no long-term strategy. No, if you want your team or your classroom, your family to truly follow you, then you have to lead from the front. They have to trust that you have their best interest in mind. Even in the military, the greatest commanders, it's not just because they say, because I said so. It's because their men trust that they know the best way and they're making the wisest decision on their behalf. They have to see that you are willing to give and to sacrifice. That's when people are willing to follow you. That's when your power stands up and makes a difference in somebody's life. It's called servant leadership, and it's the way of the Lord. And it should be how you lead in all spheres of your life. Counting on power to carry respect will always fail. Earning respect will carry you through the tough times. And now here's the final aspect of Esther to discuss today. And it's something that was written nowhere in what we read. And that is God's involvement. There is nothing in chapter 1 about God. There is nothing in the entire book of Esther that even mentions or alludes to the presence of God. And yet we're calling this series Esther and the Hidden Hand of God because of the way he's able to work through the natural decisions of people. In this story, he takes this human pride of Xerxes and this stupid fear of Memucan and maybe even rebellion from Esther. And what he does is he creates a vacant position for a queen. That's what God needed. And he allowed what happened through mankind's decisions to do exactly what he was doing. You see, we worship a God who sees things from a bigger picture than we see things. His knowledge is higher. His understanding is greater. When you're in situations and you think, I have no idea where God is in this, and I have no idea what I'm doing, that's okay. It doesn't mean that God has vacated his throne, and it doesn't mean that he's not at work in the story. We don't see God anywhere in chapter 1. And yet, as we see the rest of this book, this had to happen for there ever to be a Queen Esther and for there ever to be a Queen Esther who saved the Israelites from complete destruction. Trust that God will never stop working for your good and for his glory. Would you bow your heads with me as we pray?